Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific time at a2zen.fm, and we archive these programs for your edification and, I suppose you could say, listening enjoyment at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And we encourage you to join us as often as you can, whether it be on the live broadcast or whether it be on the replays or the archives. Doesn't make any difference. We just want to get the information out to you. And it's a beautiful time of the year for us to be talking about this. It's rather interesting from my perspective. When I first saw the materials, the perspective. Now, I've talked a little bit from time to time about my growing up, my grade school, in particular grade school years. High school wasn't quite as bad. But in grade school, I was bullied quite a bit. And high school was a little bit less, still had some of that. College, thank goodness, most of my classmates didn't go to college. As far as I know, they didn't go to the college I went to. And so I was able to escape that aspect. Although every once in a while, you know, you have the bullying thing rears its ugly head in the grocery store, on the roadway, et cetera, et cetera. Well, interestingly enough, we're not going to be talking about bullying per se. It's actually the other side of the coin. What about those significant events in your life that were actually of a positive and beneficial aspect and support to your life that you've forgotten? You forgot that Dad actually told you that he loved you. You forgot that your big brother actually put his arm around you and said, "Hey, go for it. You got what it takes. You have what it takes," and so on and so forth. I had never really thought about this until I saw this book, and until I became acquainted with the author of the book, Running on Empty: Overcoming Your Childhood Emotional Neglect. Now, what I've just described isn't exactly neglect, but we always seem to focus on the negatives. We always seem to focus on, you know, being told you're an idiot child and being pushed around and all of these. And then, of course, you go into the more extreme abusive aspects. But I had heard Jonas Webb, a PhD, author of Running on Empty, that even neglect was a form of abuse, that even if you didn't get that kind of, I'm not sure, input is a probably best way to put it. I was going to say stimulation, that it was still not real good and productive for your well-being and your upbringing. Welcome to our program, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Richard. It's nice to be here.
So, you know, I grew up in the, you know, in the 60s and 70s as a kid, and into high school in the mid-70s, and I started working in radio and interviewing people, and we talked on infinitum about all of the bad things that happened to us from our parents and our schoolmates and our siblings and our peers and so forth. And, of course, there were all kinds of programs, and I went through some of them in the 80s and 90s to try to get a handle on what my problem was, what was wrong with me. And I finally realized there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. I did have issues, like we all do. I guess they referred to them back then as baggage. But
Yes. Even
neglect is a form of abuse when people ignore you. On the one hand, I'd have to say, gee, you know, I wish my bullying peers, I don't want to call them friends, they weren't friends, I wish they had neglected me, ignored me, left me alone. I don't know if I would be any different today if that had happened. But I seem to recall reading something also about a lot of the things that were actually good that happened to us, we've forgotten, that we overlaid them with all the bad stuff. And we're kind of missing out on a big chunk of who and what we are?
Yes. Well, I think that bad events really do tend to take precedent in our minds, right? They're the most memorable things. So if a person is abused, chances are they'll remember that. But what my book is about is a more subtle type of neglect. It's not physical neglect, like a child who doesn't have shoes in the winter, for example, or food, but My book is about people who actually have, you know, pretty much their physical needs met, and their parents fail them emotionally in some way. Because emotions tend to be overlooked, number one, and something that doesn't happen gets overlooked. And emotional neglect is actually a parent's failure to do something for a child, a parent's failure to validate and respond enough to that child's emotional needs. And this is why, in my experience, I found that people don't remember it at all.
Can someone in adulthood today, even if they can go through the list, laundry list of those things that, say, their parents didn't provide them, even in saying that, can they still take 100% responsibility for their lives? They've grown enough. They've raised their consciousness enough. They've worked through their issues enough that they can do that. They can say, yes, my parents didn't give me this, didn't give me that, but I'm still responsible for who I am today.
Absolutely. The whole point of all of this is to understand what went wrong and how it happened and how it left you with the struggles that you have in adulthood, because that frees you up to do something about it. So the book is not about dragging up unnecessary stuff or blaming your parents and letting yourself off the hook. It's quite the opposite. It's understanding what went wrong and then taking responsibility for it yourself and understanding I'm an adult now, so I have to fix what didn't happen for me when I was a child, and then actually taking the actions to do that. So the second half of my book is really about how to fix it.
I'm curious as to your perspective, and it is as a psychologist, correct?
Correct, yes.
What your perspective is on a lot of the programs, especially in the 80s and the 90s that were out there. I went through a couple of different ones. One was called Life Spring. Another one, which as far as I know is still in existence, is called, went through two name changes, Omega Vector and Delta Vector. It's based out of Phoenix, Arizona. And I have to say that I did learn some valuable things. It was wonderful, but I'm wondering if that's the best way to go through the process of a group therapy of handling some of these issues.
I think it depends on the person. I'm not familiar with that second program that you mentioned, but I am familiar with LifeSpring. I know someone who has been to LifeSpring who thought it was fantastic and it really helped them. But I think some people do better, you know, sitting down with an individual therapist. Some people really need family to have their family present to fix things, and some people can do it just by on their own. So, you know, I think there's value in most anything that works for you.
Well, I can say that, you know, going through these programs, it was real interesting. In the actually, it was in the early 80s that I went through Life Spring, and I still have all of the notebooks and so forth. And every once in a while, I pull that stuff out, and I don't know that I necessarily reminisce, but I think I've gotten over that. I've let this go. No, I'm still hanging on to that one. And it's just a real interesting process for one to go through. Now, you have created within this book, Running on Empty, you've basically created four steps to, in essence, putting oneself first. The first rule of survival is take care of number one. Because if you don't take care of number one, you're no good to 2, 3, 4 and on infinitum.
Yes. The type of emotional neglect that I'm addressing in this book is the type in which the child is not really attended to as a person, as a separate person who has his own or her own feelings and needs help and likes some things and dislikes others and enjoys some things and doesn't enjoy others. When a child grows up without being asked that, like, what do you want to do? What do you want to have for dinner? Oh, you don't like this? Okay, well, let's not have that for dinner very often. If a child's needs are not noticed and paid attention to by a parent, and let's face it, no parent does this perfectly, and it's not required to do it perfectly, but if a child is treated that way enough, the child pushes her emotions down and her needs down and really gets the message, it doesn't matter what I want, it doesn't matter what I feel. it doesn't matter what I need. And then when that child grows up, a lot of adults end up wondering and not really knowing themselves and not really knowing what they like or feeling justified in expressing it. So all of those things that you just listed are skills that, learning to say no and asking for help and learning what you like and dislike and prioritizing your own enjoyment are things that don't come easily to people who have been emotionally neglected. In fact, a lot of people end up feeling really guilty if they ask for help or guilty for saying no. I'm sure we all know someone who just never says no, who will do anything you ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of times that's because they didn't have the opportunity to say no as a child, and they were programmed that way to, as an adult, feel like saying no is bad or unacceptable.
I grew up in a family of eight, two older sisters, a younger brother, and two younger sisters. And and I got to a point where I just decided that I was going to go off on my own and do my own thing. Now, that doesn't say that I don't have a good relationship with my siblings, because I do, and with my parents. But I have to wonder if that was more of a coping mechanism rather than dealing with the reasons why I felt like I needed to go out on my own. But I go back to the same question that I asked earlier. I am who I am today because of the choices that I made back then. So is there really any value in going back and rehashing these kinds of things? Because you can't change who you are today in that context.
I think that you can change who you are today. And I think the reason to go back and look at this stuff is if you are struggling as an adult with something. Mm-hmm. So the pattern that I started to see, which is the reason I wrote this book, is I do a lot of individual and family therapy, and I started to just see a lot of people, one after another, who were really pretty well-adjusted people who had their lives in order and were doing fine, and they would say, I feel like something is wrong with me. I'm not like other people. I feel like something's missing. I feel disconnected. You know, my wife says she knows that I love her, but she doesn't feel it from me. There's something different about me than other people, and I don't know what it is. And I started to realize that when I looked at people's childhoods, at what had happened to them, there was no explanation for it. Because even if they had been mistreated or abused, they'd already dealt with that, and yet they were left with this internal lack of meaning and feeling of emptiness. And it was then that I started to look at things that they couldn't remember from their childhood to try to help them. And that's how I identified that when people push their emotions away and down enough, they actually experience the absence of that as an adult. It really does feel like something is missing. And it can very much eat away at a person's enjoyment of life and connection to other people. I mean, what happened to you, it sounds like you were bullied. So if you're bullied and you remember that happening, you can deal with it and just move forward, and there's no need to go back to mm-hmm. it. But if there's something that from your childhood that you have no memory of because it's not an event, but yet you're just left feeling like something's wrong, mm-hmm. that's the time to go back and say, well, why am I feeling this way? What happened or what didn't happen to me or what didn't happen for me that could explain this?
Running on Empty is the title of the book, subtitle Overcoming Your Childhood Emotional Neglect. You can go to emotionalneglect.com to find out more about the book, as well as about Dr. Jonas Webb, who is a PhD in clinical psychology for the past 20-plus years. And you have basically in this book, you have four steps that people can go through. We're going to go through a couple of those here on the program as well. But what I want to talk about before we dive into the steps, I want to talk a little bit about why you chose psychology and also this particular venue. I mean, there are so many facets to the psyche of the human being. And they fascinate me as well. I only took a semester of psychology in college, so I don't have nearly, not even a snowflake's width of knowledge regarding psychology. But I know enough, and I've observed a lot too, especially in these programs, of myself and others, that as much as we want to say that, as much as we want to affirm is probably the right word, that we're perfect, that we're complete, that we're all these things. And on this program, you know, I have guests who talk about that, you know, that, you know, we don't need to fix anything. We're just fine the way we are. You know, we just need to recognize that fact, you know. And on one level, I agree with that. By the same token, bringing what you've already spoken to, being dissatisfied, feeling dissatisfied and connected, you can still affirm, but an affirmation is not acknowledging the reality of what is in our own minds and our emotions. So why this direction for you?
Well, in terms of the topic, I didn't choose it. It chose me. It just came out at me during years of practicing psychology as I struggled to understand people and why they were struggling with what they were struggling with. It just kind of gradually became apparent to me that people were looking in the wrong place for explanations for their adult struggles. And I wrote the book. I didn't actually want to write a book. It wasn't on my list of things to do. But I saw it so much, and it changed how I practiced so much once I started to see it, that I felt I really needed to write the book just to get this concept out there so that people can have an opportunity to see back into their childhood something they couldn't see before and have an opportunity to fix it. So that's why.
And what about your own personal experiences in your own childhood? Have you had the extraordinary experiences of being able to use these steps in that context as well? Or are you one of the rare and the few? Because I know there are some people, adults out there, who didn't have the kinds of, whether they be the neglect issues or the others, the bullying, the actual event type of issues, who actually grew up fairly well-adjusted.
Yeah, some people do have really great childhoods, which is wonderful.
If only all could have that.
Exactly. It would be great if we could get that for everyone, wouldn't it? Well, I became a psychologist really because I've been fascinated with psychology since I was a child. My mother says when I was 8, I told her I wanted to be a psychologist. And it was surprising. I even knew what it was. I think it was only because I watched the Bob Newhart show, and I really thought it was cool. He lived in a high rise, and I thought his therapy groups looked fun. So, but in reality, it was the right thing for me. So, I think it's just the way my brain works. And you know, I think in terms of emotional neglect, I think most people have some area of emotional neglect. That doesn't mean it's enough to cause damage in their life or hurt them in some way. But there's usually, you know, because no parent is perfect, pretty much everybody has some element of it. It doesn't mean they have to dig it out and fix it, because it's only important to deal with it if it's really influencing your quality of life as an adult. But I think it's hard to find someone who had such a, you know, an emotionally in tune parent that they didn't have, you know, any areas in which their parents didn't respond enough.
Well, and again, I have a great deal of love and respect for my parents and the way in which they raised me. And I'm wondering if we can just acknowledge the fact that our parents, they did the best they could with what they had at the time. They didn't know what we know today.
Absolutely. In fact, in the book, I talk about 12 different types of parents who are most likely to emotionally neglect their children. And the largest group by far is the what I call the WMBNT parent, the well-meaning but neglected themselves. Most parents really are doing their very best. And the thing about emotional neglect, though, is that because it's not memorable, people who are emotionally neglected then grow up with certain blind spots, but they are not aware of them. And so then, even though they love their children and they're doing their very best to provide their children with everything, they can't see their own blind spots. And then they, you know, they tend to just pass those on to their children without even realizing it.
Right.
So, you know, what I'm saying is most parents are really just doing the best they can, and this is not, you know, this is not about blaming them.
Right.
At all.
I think that when we start getting into that little game, and of course back in the 80s and 90s with some of these programs, that's kind of what was going on in some of these programs was, your parents did this and your parents did that, which was wrong, and that's what affected you, and so on and so forth. But they would still come up to the present day moment and say, but you're still responsible for who and what you are, regardless of what your parents did or didn't do. And so it's time to stop castigating them and blaming them and making them the bad guy. For who and what you are. Now you're an adult and it's time for you to start taking responsibility, which is a dirty word in a lot of circles, to take responsibility for one's life, because in a way our society has sort of trained us to blame others for our circumstances and conditions.
That is so true. I think that a lot of people fall into that trap, but I think there's a big difference between looking back to see what went wrong for you, because that can free you up to be able to take responsibility and fix it yourself. But what I find with a lot of people who were emotionally neglected is that because they can't see what went wrong for them in their childhood, they blame themselves for whatever they're struggling with as an adult. So most people are very protective of their parents and, you know, don't want to blame their parents. And I think the people who are really into blame and not and externalizing and not taking responsibility are a whole different group that my book is not even really geared to. My book is really targeted to people who feel responsible that they there's something wrong with them and it's their own fault. And then once you can look back and see, oh, so that's why I have so much trouble connecting to people or getting myself to the gym, or that's one we haven't talked about yet, or, understanding what people are feeling, it's because this happened in childhood. Okay, so it's not my fault. Once that frees up a lot of energy to stop blaming yourself, and then you can actually attack it and start fixing it in a different way with a different kind of energy.
I have struggled with the paradox, as I perceive it anyway, of an individual, an adult, working person, contributing to society, is where they are. And they have these hopes, dreams, and aspirations and desires of going higher. And they work to do everything that they know how to do just that. They might even play the lottery to get that big payoff so that they can maybe do the things they say they want to do. And they struggle and they have this strife and this inner turmoil, and it goes on and on and on. They want to better their lives, whether it be their work or relationships and so forth. And I question whether or not it's worth the effort, because they're not seeing the results. They're not seeing the payoff. They're trying to do everything. They're trying to work through all of this stuff to achieve that higher level of being, if you will. And after a while, you know, it can get very discouraging. And that's why I'm wondering, are we where we're supposed to be? Is this my lot in life? Is this where I'm going to be the rest of my days? You know, I have to outlive my great-grandmother, who lived to be over 100, so you can see at age 52, I have a long way to go. But I'm wondering, are we stuck, or is it these elements of whether it be the invisible neglect or the bullying or whatever, however you want to phrase it, the issues that we're dealing with, are these the things that are holding us back, that if we just freed ourselves up from those, we could rise up to new heights and so forth? Is that the I don't want to oversimplify it, but is that the magic elixir, if you will?
Yeah, I don't think there is a magic elixir at all. And I guess it depends what you're striving for. If you're striving for a second, you know, Mercedes-Benz in your garage, that's very different than striving to improve your marriage and be a better parent and feel happier with yourself and more connected with your family and the people that you love. I think all of those are things that we all really should be striving for and actually have a responsibility to strive for. Because the more we improve ourselves in all of those areas, the happier we're going to make all the people around us. The better parent will be, the better spouse will be, the better friend will be, and the better friend will be to ourselves as well.
Mm. Well, I think that these are very important points to take a look at. We're also going to take a look at the four steps to putting yourself first, self-care strategies to heal from childhood emotional neglect. Janice Webb is my guest, and we are talking about her book that actually you co-wrote with Christine Muslow?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, she's a contributor.
Okay.
She started the book with me, but wasn't able to finish it.
Well, we are certainly grateful for your appearance here on the program. We're going to continue talking more about the four steps with Janice Webb, author of Running on Empty, here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
I'm Richard Dugan, along with Janice Webb, author of Running on Empty, and it's dealing with a lot of the issues that we've carried around with us for, you know, for longer than I care to really think about. You know, Janice, it's one of those things. It's like, I remember when I was in my 20s and 30s going through these programs, one of the first thoughts that went through my head, I think arrogantly so, was, when are these people going to get it? Because I had been interviewing on this subject and talking with all of the different authors and listening to people like Wayne Dyer and Leo Buscaglia in that day and so on and so forth, and Og Mandino. And I think, when are these people going to get it? And then it dawned on me, you're in the same room with them, you knucklehead. When am I going to get it? And just by not going doesn't mean that I got it by any means. But we're all struggling with the same stuff. And I know that there are a myriad of books out there with the 10 steps to this, the 7 steps to that, and on, and the list goes on infinitum. But you have 4 basic steps that you have already alluded to: learning to say no and asking for help, as well as discovering your likes and dislikes. But I think my favorite one is number 4, and I'm not sure if these are prioritized per se, that you have to go through them one step at a time, or if they're interchangeable: prioritizing your enjoyment. I moved to Santa Barbara because I wanted to be close to the ocean, and yet I find that I don't take as much time as I'd like to be there. I mean, I'm still living here, and I live up on the mountain, and we come down and so forth, but actually being on the sandy beach, whether it's in my beach chair or barefoot or what have you, and it's like, what went wrong here?
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the prioritizing of enjoyment, and I guess let me back it up and say, are these prioritized, or can you basically, you go at these in whatever way that you choose to go at them?
Well, they don't all apply to everyone who is emotionally neglected. It depends in what area your emotional neglect occurred. So the idea, they're not in an order that you have to do them in. It's more figure out the ones that apply to you and then try to fix those. And there's a program in the book for each one of these to work on it. But about prioritizing your own enjoyment, I think that is a really big one. And some people have no problem with that at all, and they always put their own enjoyment first. And you can do that, you know, you can go too far with that if you're too self-centered. But what I found is that people who were emotionally neglected tend to have the opposite problem, that they don't necessarily feel entitled to their own enjoyment. So they'll tend to, you know, put other people's needs before their own. And for example, if you're a parent and you have a child who you know, you have a free Saturday and your child wants to go to the Children's Museum, but you would really love to go to the Museum of Fine Arts, and your kid's been to the Children's Museum 5 times in the last month, are you going to be able to say, well, let's do what mom wants today? Or are you going to always give in and do what someone else wants?
Mm.
And, you know, I don't know, you're living there on the ocean, I'm jealous. I just had to throw that in.
Well, and the irony is that the only way that I was, well, I shouldn't say the only way, but the way that we got here was the fact that both my wife and I, we lost our jobs in February and March of 2006. And we had a little nest egg set aside, and we said, well, as much as we want to move to Ireland, and there are a few more hurdles to get through to live there, let's move to your hometown. And, you know, within 3 months, boom, we were here. So it's one of those things where, I mean, the events in and of themselves are so peculiar. I have to wonder how in the world I was able to rise above some of the stuff that I've dealt with most of my life emotionally to say, hey, this is a good and safe thing to do. Let's do it. Because honestly, I had no fear whatsoever through the process. No fear at all. Even being questioned on a couple of occasions as to whether or not this was the right choice, I always said, absolutely, it was absolutely the right choice, you know. And, of course, it was jumping into the great void because we didn't know what was going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
So I have to wonder sometimes if people, in spite of all of this stuff, that they're the baggage that we'll call it, they still manage to excel and achieve and rise above.
Yes, well, it sounds like you took a really negative situation and made it positive by making a choice that can lead you to be a lot happier. You kind of made it into an opportunity, and some people are really able to do that, which is great.
Is it also true that if you make a change in your life, and you do it for a minimum of 30 days, that it then really becomes a part of who and what you are? It doesn't really make a whole lot of, like, some people, maybe they want to meditate. And if you can stick to doing it, even if it's just for short periods of time and then you lengthen it and so forth, but you do that for 30 days or you go somewhere to help someone and you do this process for 30 days, that's where some of the change comes in. I've heard that said, that 30 days is sort of somewhat of a magic number in that regard, that if you can do that.
Yeah, I think if you can do something for 30 days, it's going to make it easier to keep doing it. But it's not necessarily going to take all of the burden off of you. A lot of people still have to, you know, make themselves do things after 30 days. But, you know, if you can make it for a month, then you're probably on the downhill there, and it's going to become easier. It's just hard to make changes in general, but
right,
the idea is to just do it and then keep at it. You just have to keep working at it.
It's kind of an irony, though, isn't it? We say that we don't like things the way they are. Well, that more than just implies that we want things to change, but if they change, we we fight against it.
Yeah, that's probably because change is difficult, right? I mean, in some ways, what's comfortable is what you already know, even if it's not the best thing. So I think it's really hard for people to make changes.
So when we talk about these four steps in particular, or maybe just talking in general about the book Running on Empty, or talking more in general about the work that you do one-on-one with people and so forth, Is there always the requirement that there must be some kind of a cathartic emotional expression or for a breakthrough to happen?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think, and as a society, we're kind of in love with the idea of breakthroughs and, you know, epiphanies and ahas.
Yeah.
But I don't think it really happens all that often. And I think people miss opportunities to change because they're expecting that feeling.
A particular form.
An aha. What was that?
A particular form, if you will, of
yes,
expression.
They want to feel that, oh, feeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my experience as a psychologist, it does happen on occasion, but it's kind of rare. Most people figure things out kind of, you know, step by step, a little bit at a time, and it sort of gradually dawns. Mm-hmm. The truth dawns slowly, I would say. So.
And I know that people are, well, I mean, even during my time, I know this was going on long before I ever came along on the scene, especially in the 60s and 70s. But when I was going through these programs during the 80s and 90s and reading all of the self-help books and so forth, you know, it was amazing how many people were, and as the phrase would go, they were working on themselves. It was the equivalent of the 60s, I'm going to go find myself. And you really can't go anywhere to find yourself because you're already there, no matter where you are. But I'm wondering if here we are in the 21st century, and I'll be honest with you, Janice, I thought we would be so much further along, technologically especially. I mean, I was watching the Jetsons as a kid growing up, and that's what I thought the 21st century was going to be like. And it isn't even close. It's like it's just a more technologically complex version of what I grew up with. And that's a bit of a struggle for some folks. They really hope for something better, and they want something better, and they're trying to achieve it. Through the four steps that you have outlined, can you prioritize the steps in terms of where they should start in that context of, okay, I can't create a flying car. Okay, we won't go overboard here. But how does one change one's perception so that they can better cope with the status quo and yet stay hopeful and optimistic for the change in that regard?
Well, I think that the four steps are all really aspects of putting yourself first,
okay,
which is the real thing that people who are emotionally neglected struggle with a lot. And it's really because they didn't have the experience of being put first in childhood enough. So they took away the message that they don't matter, that what they want or need doesn't matter. So the four steps are really about learning how to do what you need to do for yourself and feel good about that as opposed to feeling guilty or feeling bad about it. And, you know, I take your point that we want to race ahead and we want things to progress and we want fast results in our society, which is kind of built into being human, I think. We all want that instant mm-hmm. gratification. It would be great if we had flying cars, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
But things just don't work that way, so you kind of have to deal with what you're dealt with, deal with the hand that you're dealt. So really, you know, learning these skills, the first step to it is, it might seem like a very small step, but it actually is a huge one, which is recognizing that there's a problem and what the problem is and defining it and then really starting to, you know, making a decision, I want to fix this, I want to change this. If it's impacting yourself and your life and your family, then it makes sense to put the effort into it. Change really does take effort.
And yet, on the one hand, yes, we must deal with the hand that we were dealt, but that doesn't mean that we can't put down a couple of three cards and ask for three more. Using that metaphor, if you will.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
I mean, we can, and that's and honestly, that's really what the process of what you're talking about in your book and these four steps are all about, is just doing that. Yes, I need to accept the way things are, but I can also plan for, do some things. But this also goes to that issue that you've already talked about, and that is putting yourself first. And not, I think this was the criticism of the 70s, 80s, and 90s programs that I've mentioned, that they were a little bit on the narcissistic side. You know that I'm more important, and I am this great person, and on and on and on. And I think that it probably went, the pendulum swung pretty far to that other extreme. And now we're kind of trying to bring it back more to a middle ground that I'm not the most important person in the world. I am important, and I deserve to have some things in my life that I want, but not to the detriment of others or the rest of society. I think that maybe that's where the 21st century is starting to take us. Your thoughts?
I'm not familiar enough with those programs that you were talking about, but I can imagine how it could happen that you could get the message that your needs are come before everything else and the world revolves around you. But I think it's hard to really become that type of personality if you weren't raised that way somehow. You know, most of us, you know, our personalities really reflect how our parents raised us, and we resist that idea, but it just is the way it is. It's proven over and over and over again by research. And so we kind of have to, that's what I mean when I say we have to accept what we're dealt with, but then start from there, like recognizing it and then starting from there. But also you're kind of touching a little bit on the idea of, you know, I think there was a book called The Princess, Raising Your Princess or something like that. That's not the right title, but, you know, about how parents now are giving their children the message that they are, you know, they're the best thing in the world.
Right.
And that nothing's as good as them. And, you know, that's swinging too far in the other direction, and it's really not a good thing.
Are you at all familiar? I don't want to go down a road that you're not familiar with, but I'm curious as to if whether you've heard of the latest, and I saw this on a 60 Minutes piece, this baby research, where what they were trying to find out was if we come into the world with, I think the term probably would be appropriate, discrimination and even judgment for that matter. And they did these various experiments with these babies and used puppets and so forth to see if they would pick up on justice and injustice, even as infants. And what they found was, yeah, that we actually do. There was a way for them to actually track this. It was amazing to me. And so what you're saying, I think, is, you know, is even more true, because if we have these built-in moral compasses, if you will, that are set to a certain degree, then I would think that the added aspects as well. I mean, I've even thought about this from the genetic standpoint, Janice, and that is, if little Billy, who is a week, 10 days old, is being seen by all the relatives, and each one of the relatives spouts off about how, oh, he has Aunt Vern's ears and Uncle Bill's smile, and they go down this list of physical characteristics that they can attribute to others, then why isn't it possible that also, and as they grow, they hear about the behavior of the child. Oh, well, yeah, he's got Uncle Fred's temper, or he's got Aunt Lily's laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why wouldn't that also extend to the intellect and even the spiritual aspect? Why wouldn't we be, I mean, if it's all part of the same coding, then we would be to some degree sort of predisposed, pre-programmed in a general way. I don't want to say real specifics, but in a general way, wouldn't that be a fair assumption or a bad assumption on my part?
Well, you know, back in the 1940s, people, like doctors, actually thought that babies were completely living in their own world, and they didn't take in anything from their environment or put anything meaningful into the environment. Babies were thought to basically just be just kind of very independent, discrete creatures that were not connected. And then over time, in the 1950s and 60s, all this research was done about what's called attachment theory, which is, have you heard of attachment theory?
I have not.
It's about how a parent-child interaction, the power that it has. And they've done many, many studies since the 1940s or 50s, I think it's more 50s, that prove that they can watch a mother-child interaction with an infant and then see the behaviors that took place between that mother and baby in the adult's behavior many years later once that child grows up. So, you know, part of it is genetic, of course, you know, mannerisms, and maybe some of us are wired to have a different, you know, type of temper than another person. I think anyone who has kids can say they're, you know, children are born with some elements of personality already there.
Mm-hmm.
But also the child just keeps, it's sort of like a little computer, and it just keeps getting programmed and programmed all the way through childhood.
Yeah.
And then in adulthood, you've got those programs in you. And if you're going to change them, you really do have to decide, I'm going to change this program. I don't like how it's running. And substitute another program in.
Now there's
does that address what you're asking?
It does. And it actually goes to even a biblical passage that I see sort of, it's a double-edged sword of sorts. And maybe not so much that as much as it has two sides to it. And that is that train a child up in the way he should go, and when he gets old, he will not depart from it. So then you wonder why adults behave the way they are. Guess what? It's because that's the way they were trained. That's the way, as you use the term programmed. That's the way that they were programmed. So if you, again, using the term programmed loosely, if you program a child in certain ways, then there is a certain element of determination that this is the way this child will be. I mean, there's no guarantee of its career or relationships or what path it will take. But maybe in terms of its moral compass, its conscience, its consciousness and its self-awareness and so forth, its intellect, those things, I think, you know, you give them a great education, you know. I heard a term just the other day, as a matter of fact. They didn't use the term education. They used the term real education.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was rather an interesting twist on the phrase, or meaningful education, as opposed to, I guess, what's out there now. But again, it goes back to what you were saying before. These infants, they're like sponges, and they just they just take in and take in and take in, and we have no clue as to how they're going to wind up. I mean, and that's been one of the interesting, I guess you could say, phenomena. There's no way to predict, in spite of a lot of the movies that have come out, like Minority Report. That was a rather interesting, from my perspective, rather interesting and telling thing that, oh, we want to stop people from committing crimes before they ever think about committing them. Yeah, I don't think you can do that. I find that those kinds of things are real interesting, but I do think that we have the opportunity here through a lot of different modalities, including the work that you have done and the book you have put out called Running on Empty, Overcoming Your Childhood Emotional Neglect, and the four steps that you've outlined in your book as well, that we can make a difference not only in our children, but obviously also in ourselves and make a better world, which is what we're trying to do through this program, is saying, look, it goes back to the issue of change, Janice. A lot of us don't like things the way they are, and we want to do things differently. And who's to say that the way that it's been done for the last 100 or 500 or 1,000 years is the way that it has to be for the next 500 or 1,000 years?
Right. Wouldn't we hope that we're evolving and learning how to do things differently so that we improve the next generation continually?
Well, that is the general concept anyway.
That's what we're trying for.
I think that the continuation, and I also think that this is starting to wane a little bit, the continuation of the polarization of the populations. I think the populations, I think, are actually much more intelligent, and they know better. than to buy into a lot of the messages that they're starting to they've been hearing over the last 20, 30, 40 years through the media. You know, they're saying, hey, look, no, that's not what I want. It doesn't. And it goes to the two terms that you use to describe the feelings that we have in regards to this issue of emotional neglect, feeling dissatisfied and disconnected. And just because I don't have a PhD or a master's or a BA or I don't have anything, to be honest with you, doesn't mean that I can't tap into that feeling of dissatisfaction and disconnectedness and saying something's not right here. I want something better.
Exactly. And I would say that society contributes to that partly by giving people the message that feelings and emotion are, you know, insipid and dumb and useless and, you know, in the way of logical thought. I think a lot of our world looks at things this way. And it, you know, as I said before, when we push away emotion and feeling, we're giving up a valuable source of feedback and connection and direction in life, because if we listen to our feelings, they'll tell us what to do a lot of the time. And if we learn how to manage them, we can use them in order to do things for ourselves and for others to make our lives better. But if we get the message either from our parents or society that our emotions are irrelevant or useless, then we're going to end up losing that great opportunity and feeling it too, and feeling disconnected and different.
This is a little down a tangent of sorts, but I'm curious as to your perception, if you will, or perspective on the role of, because you used the term trusting our feelings, the spiritual aspect to us as beings and its role in this whole emotional neglect and dissatisfaction and disconnection.
From my viewpoint as a psychologist, the true meaning of life comes from our connections to other people. It's our relationships with the people that we care about and with all of the people in the world that gives life its meaning. This is from my point of view. I'm sure not everyone agrees with this. But it's our feelings and our emotion that gives us that connection. So when we push those feelings away, we do end up feeling alone and disconnected because we've lost the fuel that feeds that connection.
And so, I mean, I'm curious, in terms of the discussion on infants and this study and so on and so forth, so do we come into this world pre-programming? Do we come into this world with a full tank, or is it empty and it's only filled through the human interaction that we have in our lives?
I think it gets filled through the interaction.
Okay.
I think, you know, if a baby is, you know, they've done studies on babies who grow up in orphanages where they don't get enough touch or enough attention, you know, that baby grows up to show signs of that, of being, you know, a disconnected adult and a person who maybe doesn't know how to relate to others. So I really think that it's through our parents seeing what we feel and responding appropriately to that fills us up and gives us that connection and that meaning and that self-understanding and self-awareness and emotional connection that then feeds the rest of our lives and fuels the rest of our lives.
Well, first of all, I'm very grateful for the work that you're doing. Your perspective is as valuable and as integral to our future civilization, to be honest with you, if we're even going to have one, as many of my guests on the program. And that, again, the whole point of this broadcast is to provide these different points. I call it on the circle, because we can't see it all from where we're standing. we have to kind of move around, and this program kind of, it moves around to these different points on the circle and gives people an idea of the different choices that are out there, the different opportunities. In this case, it's running on empty, overcoming your childhood emotional neglect. And Janice Webb, PhD, is my guest, and we're talking about this book that she has put out to help you to understand about your feelings of dissatisfaction and disconnection in your life. And it's basically not about what happens to you as a child. It's about what failed to happen for you as a child. I wanted to touch upon one other thing before we wrap up our program. And again, we've already said we're not blaming anybody. But when a
right.
parent says to the adult that, hey, I did the very best I could. I wish that I had done more when this was happening to you as a child. Is that something that we can look to and say, okay, I can accept that? Or, I mean, is that really up to the individual saying, no, I don't buy it. You didn't do what you were supposed to do as a parent, and I blame you, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I guess from your vantage point and from this book, Running on Empty, is that something that we need to look at and say, thank you for acknowledging, for the most part, just acknowledging that you wish you had done more?
I think that's an incredibly healing comment for a parent to make to his or her adult child. And especially if it's absolutely true and the parent feels it when the parent is saying it, mm-hmm. it's incredibly healing. But that's not to say that, you know, I wouldn't say anyone whose parent says that to them should forgive them, because it could be a complicated story of all kinds of bad things. And, you know, maybe the parent really wasn't doing the best they could, because not all parents do.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's different with the situation, but that kind of a comment made to a child is a wonderful and healing thing.
So one of the first steps is to acknowledge the reality of the way things are, as well as the way things were, to take a look at those. And how did you phrase it? I mean, you used the term in regards to emotional neglect. It's more of a passive event. It's not an active event, right?
Right. It's not a parent's act. It's a parent's failure to act, which is why we don't remember it.
Okay. And then to begin the process of taking a look at these four steps in your book, you want to learn to say no, ask for help, discover your likes and dislikes, and prioritize your enjoyment. And one of my priorities, as far as enjoyment is concerned, is these programs. And I am grateful that you have taken the time to share with us today, Janice.
Thank you so much for having me on.
My guest again, Janice Webb, PhD, author of Running on Empty, Overcoming Your Childhood Emotional Neglect. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story. A reminder that if you are listening to the radio program and we come to the end, there's more. If you are listening to the A2Zen.fm broadcast, there's more. Go to RichardDugan.com, the radio show's page, and click on the interview, the play button for this interview, and you will hear the entire interview that spans an hour. So we hope that you will gather that additional information. I'm Richard Dugan, and until next Saturday at this same time, love Talal.